Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further, faster. I'm Andy Stanley. And before we jump into today's incredible content, and it is so good, I wanted to talk to you about our partner, Belay, whose company's remote culture has ranked number one in Entrepreneur Magazine. Ready for this? Five times and counting, and their product is more relevant than ever. In this season where so many of us are working remotely, maintaining culture is more critical than ever, and it's more difficult than ever. And to help address this, for a limited time, Belay is offering their resource, The Culture Cure, free to all of our listeners. In it, you'll learn about eight critical factors to cultivate a culture that unites a remote workforce to work towards common goals, regardless of zip, area, or even country code. To learn more, download your copy of The Culture Cure for free by texting Andy to 31996. That's just text Andy to 31996. Or you can just visit belaysolutions.com/Andy. That's B-E-L-A-Y solutions.com/Andy. And now, let's jump into today's conversation. Well, I'm super excited about this month because I'm chatting with my friend that I have not seen in such a long time, Patrick Lencioni, about his brand new book, The Motive. So, Pat, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you. I think it took a total shutdown in society to get us together because we've been trying to.
Yeah, I know. We've been so busy. Yeah, yeah. If you had said, hey, it's great to be here, I was going to have to explain. These days, here is relative, right? Where is here? Normally, I have guests in the studio with me, but not this time. You are on the West Coast in lockdown. What's that like?
This is actually in California, in the Bay Area. This is the beginning of week three.
Wow.
So we have been in our home going for walking the dog. Not much more than that.
That's amazing.
For 3 weeks. So it's an interesting time.
Wow. Well, for most of our listeners, they have read one or more of your books. And if they haven't read your books, they've heard me quote you so many times, they probably feel like they have read one or more of your books. Pat is one of the founders of the Table Group. He's a pioneer of the organizational health movement. He's authored 11 books, sold over 6 million copies, been translated into 30 languages. But most significantly to me, if you wander around our offices, you will see his books everywhere in all the cubes, bookshelves. I search in vain for my books, but his books can be found everywhere in our office. They just put mine out when they know I'm walking by. So this is a conversation with a guy who has impacted me personally in my leadership and certainly in our organization. Pat spends most of his time speaking and writing about leadership, teamwork, organizational health. He's a consultant. He's got a team of consultants. And we are so fortunate in our organization to have one of his consultants as part of our board. So we are in lockstep and in constant learning mode. So anyway, hey, before we jump into talking about your brand new book, which is fabulous, by the way, you've already brought it up, because of what we're going through right now, are you giving any specific or any different advice to leaders these days? You know, we say that uncertainty is job security for leaders, and it is. It's uncertainty that, you know, demands leadership. What are you telling folks? Tell me. Help me.
Well, you know, about a week and a half ago, I was up in the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep when all this lockdown started. And I had this thought like at 5 a.m. And so we sent it out to our list of clients and others. And I thought it was pretty straightforward, but I was shocked by how people responded, because all I said was three things. I said, during this time, it's really important for leaders to be, first, exceedingly human. Be vulnerable, be human, let people know what your concerns are, let them know what you don't know, and be a human being with vulnerability up front. And because people don't trust you if you're not vulnerable, and it's very tempting for leaders during times like this to say, no, I've got it all under control, I'm not really concerned, everything's fine. And they actually lose people that way.
Yep.
And so I said, be exceedingly human. The second thing I said is be persistent with your people. Check in with them. Call them a lot. It's easy to go, well, they're busy with their family. They don't know. People want to be connected to the people they work with. Yep. And the leader sets the tone for that. And so be extra persistent and bother people to check in with them, to tell them what's going on. 6 months from now, nobody's going to look back and say, man, my manager really bothered me. He or she just cared too much about me. Yep. And was bothering me all the time. What they're going to say is they left me alone. I don't think they cared. That's a bad thing. So we said, be persistent. The last one is be creative. Try things you wouldn't normally do. People are going to give you grace if you do something that looks silly.
Yep.
And most of it doesn't look silly at all. And bring children onto your Zoom calls. You know,
wow.
Talk to people about things you don't normally talk about. Talk about TV and movies and family and friends, and be creative in how you do that. People responded and said, this helps me so much. And what it reminded me of, Andy, is how much leaders need to be reminded these days about what's really important. And how simple reminders that seem so obvious are not really all that obvious, because when you get into a crisis, you lose some of that stuff.
Well, I score a 1 out of 3 on those three things. So let's just wrap up. And I have I already have homework to do, and we haven't even started talking about your fabulous book. Yes, my staff, I try to be approachable. I think I am. You know, you never really know. But I have been encouraged, Andy, be more personable, be more vulnerable. I mean, they've used those words like, don't be so scripted, because I'm generally very scripted because every word matters. And they've said, hey, in your opening little monologues with our congregation every week, because it's all online now,
right,
just get off the script and be, you know, be a human being. And it is not intuitive for me when I'm in work mode. And so you're exactly right. So thanks for the reminder.
Sure. And some Myers-Briggs type make that easier. And I think, yes, I know yours. And so though you're a minister and a preacher, you're not an extrovert. And so yep. So this is a time to over extrovert, because people need to see those things.
Yes, I will be working against my temperament. And a lot of what's in this book coincides with that, because, again, some things come more natural than others. And for some of us, is as much as I genuinely care, nobody, you know, nobody can see my heart. If it's not in my words and in my facial expressions, I leave people guessing, and that's unfair. So you, those three things, those are really powerful. So, wow.
Great.
Hey, one more thing before we jump into the book. We are going to get to it, I promise. The book is called The Motive, and it seemed to me, as I read the book, and of course, I read the book as this began. So, of course, that's,
right,
you know, I'm filtering everything, you know, through current events, whether that's fair or not, because you wrote the book long before all this stuff hit the fan. But it seems to me, as leaders, our motives are on display. This kind of pressure and this kind of churn and angst in our culture as an organizational leader, whereas we, you know, we can hide our motives and, you know, the people closest to us sometimes know. Is there a sense in which this kind of pressure just squeezes it out of us, whether we're even aware of it or not? I mean, what's the relationship between this kind of pressure and motive? Because it seems to me they are connected.
Oh, yeah. I think that in a raw time like this, people see us more than ever for who we really are. And I think because it's tougher for us to put on airs.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things we say to leaders is, people are going to remember how you act and what you do now,
yeah,
for years to come, far more than they will what you said or did during normal times, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And so I think this is a time where leaders are going to look at themselves and emerge stronger and become better leaders. And if they don't, that's going to be laid bare, and they're going to really lose the followership that they want and need.
I think you're exactly right. And again, as busy as a lot of us are, and that's what's so interesting too about right now, and is some of us are busier than we've ever been because we're having to turn the ship. And then there are other people in our organization, there's really virtually almost nothing for them to do because we're an event organization, and suddenly,
right,
we're not doing any events. So again, you're right. The whole over-communicate, which you talk a lot about, in your book, you make a point in the book, I know I'm jumping way ahead, which I thought was great. You already brought it up. Nobody ever leaves an organization because the leadership over-communicated. Nobody ever said,
right,
I'm out of here. I am so sick and tired about hearing what we're doing and why we're doing it and where we're going. And we all tend to underdo that. And now more than ever, the second point you mentioned a minute ago, now's the time to just load up on mission, vision, why, where, and all that stuff. So anyway,
yep.
Okay, so to this fabulous book, and I don't know if this is a good place to start or not, but you said that this should have been the first book you've written, and your books are fabulous. So what, again, if you had it to do all over again, apparently you would start here. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because most of my books, like so many other people who write about leadership and management, talk about how to do it. And what I realized later in my career was that there's a lot of people who looked at the recommendations I was making and they were puzzled by it because I had not addressed why they became a leader in the first place. And if you became a leader for the wrong reason, which I call reward-centered leadership, because you did it for yourself and because you thought being a leader seemed kind of cool and it was a reward for a lifetime of hard work, then the things I recommend in all of my books are going to seem kind of odd. But if you became a leader for the right reason, which is because you're responsibility centered, you're taking on a burden for others, then it all makes sense. So what I realized is I was assuming in all my books that people were doing it for the right reason. But if people haven't questioned that in themselves, then it's going to be harder for them to accept the how-tos in my other books. So if somebody said to me, Pat, here, I have your 11 books here on a stack, what should I start with? I'd say start with this one.
Wow. Well, that's I know you're not doing it for this, but that's a selling point because a lot of people have read most or all of your books. So for you to say that says a lot. And having read the book, I understand why you're saying that. Well, Pat, before we continue, to all of our podcast listeners, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, our sponsor, Belay, is offering their resource, The Culture Cure, for free to all of our listeners. So if you're trying to find ways to maintain your culture in a remote context, which is not easy to do, just text Andy to 31996. That's just Andy to 31996 to ensure your workforce culture thrives in this extraordinary season. And this is true regardless of your zip area or even your country code. Don't miss this opportunity. Now, you start the book this way, and I'm just going to read this paragraph because I thought, what an interesting way to start a book. You write, whenever I hear a graduate, and I think part of the reason I love this is I've thought this before, but I didn't know you could say it out loud, but you did. So whenever I hear a graduation speaker exhort a group of students to go out into the world and be a leader, you say, I want to stand up and shout, no, please don't be a leader unless you're going to do it for the right reason, and you probably aren't. And then in front of one of the largest leadership gatherings in our country at a conference, you opened up by saying, not everyone should be a leader. And as obvious and as intuitive as that is a controversial idea. So talk a little bit about where are you coming from? What are you talking about?
Yeah, you know, the truth is the world isn't better when people want to be leaders and they don't know why, or they're doing it for themselves. And that seems obvious, but the fact of the matter is when you exhort a person to be a leader and they don't have a reason for being that way, or they haven't developed humility and selflessness, that encourages destruction. Hmm. And what I love about this is people have read this book and said to me, CEOs have said, this book rocked me to my core, because I realized some of my motives were not the right ones and I needed to change them.
Yeah. And a motive is a very difficult thing to unearth, and then, you know, the courage to examine our motives. It's honestly, it's terrifying.
Yeah. Hey, when I was a kid, I remember I was a leader. You know, I was the student body president, and I was the captain of the team and all those other things. But heck, I was a kid. I think I probably wanted to be cool and I wanted to get chicks.
Yeah.
and that's not a good reason to be a leader. Now, that's young people have not always figured this out. But by the time we get older, if we haven't reground ourselves in the service of others, and if we don't come to the conclusion that the reality is leadership has bad economics, the personal economics of leadership is not good. You are going to give far more than you're going to get. If you haven't resolved yourself to that, you are going to cause problems.
Wow. And every single person listening has been in an organization or a family where, because of what you just said, created some of the most personal hardships, organizational hardships because of that very thing. So in the book, you boil it down to these two motives. And so let's talk about what they are and how in the world did you I mean, you know, we could say there's 20 motives or 15 motives or 12 motives, but you do a great job at distilling this down to these two big ideas. So what are they, and how did you come to that conclusion?
Right. Well, I remember when I was in Palm Springs at a leadership conference, and I was doing a Q&A session with about 20 CEOs in a big suite of this hotel. And they were sitting around in like this big suite living room, and we were talking and they were asking me questions. And some of them were arguing with my answers. And I was like, gosh, it seems like these are pretty straightforward. And they were like, I'm not going to do that. Why would I do that? And it occurred to me, wait a second, why are some of these people in this room saying, of course we would do that. That's great advice. And other people seem to be dismissing all of it out of hand. And it dawned on me that some of them probably were thinking that doesn't do anything for me.
Hmm.
That's a hard thing. If your motive is wrong, you're not going to want to do hard things. And that's where I realized there's really two. There's a binary thing. Is it about others? Do you think this is a stewardship? That's what I call responsibility centered. I'm a leader. This is a burden.
Wow.
I have to take things on for the good of others. And again, the personal economics are not good. Or this is all about personal economics. I'm going to do things that benefit me. And if something comes up that I have to do because I'm a reward-centered leader, I'm not going to do it unless I see the reward in it for myself. And, you know, you and I are believers, Andy. And the truth of the matter is, if you're a leader, and Jesus modeled this, I mean, he introduced this into the world. I couldn't believe when I heard a guy wrote a book and talked about how the idea of leading, taking a secondary position to others, sacrificing yourself for others, was actually not even considered wisdom. We take that for granted in a post-Christian world.
It was considered weakness.
Exactly.
Yeah, compassion was weakness. Anything that showed, you know, that somebody else is going to get ahead of me was not a virtue. It was the opposite of a virtue in ancient times.
Exactly. And so now when I say this, people go, oh, yeah, that's probably true. But there's a lot of people today that have rejected that and said, listen, it's about me. So that was a long answer to a short question. But the two kinds of leadership are reward-centered, it's about what I get, or responsibility-centered, it's about the burden and what I give.
As is the case with most of your books, you begin with a parable. And I wrote, I know I was supposed to just read through the parable and then get to the kind of the teaching part of the book, but I wrote down and cut and pasted so many of the statements from the parable. Can I just read a couple of those and let respond to them? It's so powerful. One of the characters, and we won't give away the whole parable part because it's so powerful, the sort of Yoda character says, I'm more curious about what you think you really do to help the business. How do you see your job in terms of verbs? I love that statement. How do you see your job in terms of verbs? Because verbs force me to think outside of what's coming in my direction. Verbs are the things that I'm supposed to do. I love that. How do you see your job in terms of verbs? Can you comment on that a little bit? We'll move on.
Yeah, some people talk about being a CEO and they think about it as the noun. Like, I'm the chief executive officer. And one of the things this character says in the book is that you should actually think you're the chief executing officer. It's like, what are you doing? And the way you know, you can kind of back out of what you think you're, if you're reward-centered or responsibility-centered, by what you're willing to do for others. Hmm. And there's a number of things that a lot of leaders just don't like to do because they're not pleasant. It's kind of like I'm being a parent saying, okay, I want to be a parent. And it's like, okay, so changing a diaper in the middle of the night, you want to do that. You know, being there, watching your kids suffer, you want to do that.
Yeah.
Having to you know, there's so many verbs and people go, well, I'm not really into that. I just want to have the accoutrement of having a nice picture and having them around for easy times. And it's the same thing as a leader. When you do the CEO, you're doing a lot of selfless things. And if you're not into those verbs, you shouldn't do the job.
Yeah. One of the conversations in the book, one of the characters asked another character, do you want to be a CEO or do you want to do what CEOs do? Again, such an insightful question, because just about everybody wants to be the CEO in terms of the reward. But do you want to do CEO? Completely different question.
Yeah. You know, I love analogies. And the only thing in sports that's happening right now as we record this is the NFL draft, because it's not actually sports. It's just picking teams. And I like to think about, like, when somebody gets picked by a team, they either are going to say, wow, I just got drafted. I'm going to make money. I'm finally a professional player. Wow, this is the reward for a lifetime of hard work. I want to be an NFL player. Or they're going to say, oh my gosh, they just picked me. They're going to pay me. I have to get to work. I have to learn the playbook. I have to work out because I have to do what's required because I don't want to make them feel like I'm not stewarding this opportunity.
Yeah, this isn't the end. This is the beginning.
Exactly. And so being a CEO should be a pause for concern, not a relief and a sense of accomplishment.
Wow.
And that's true if you're managing if you're a principal of a school, a pastor of a church, the manager of a department, or anything, any kind of role of leadership. It's the doing, not the being.
Yep.
And that's selfless.
Yep. So, Pat, next time we get together, we're going to talk about some of those verbs. But as we wrap up this part of the discussion, real quick, you've written so much about building cohesive teams, leadership teams. Again, so much great information. Why is this whole idea of right motive so important when it comes to healthy organizations? Not just necessarily a healthy CEO, but how does this trickle down or impact an entire organization, or does it?
Well, because, you know, if leaders abdicate or delegate, and delegate is often abdicate.
Yep.
The most important responsibilities of their job, which are often the hardest ones that we'll talk about next time, they are not going to make their organization healthy because nobody else can do the job of the chief executive has many responsibilities that no one else by definition can do. Just like the principal of a school, the pastor of a church, the CEO of an organization, there's certain things that only they can do.
Yep.
And if they're not willing to do that, they're going to create a vacuum and it's going to create politics and dysfunction. And that is going to prevent the organization from being healthy. So it's up to that leader to fulfill their responsibility or it's just not going to work.
So if I don't embrace my verbs, the folks that report to me probably aren't going to embrace their verbs either.
No, absolutely not. Because they yeah. need you to do yours so yep. they can do that, even if their intentions are
no,
great.
That's exactly right. And even with an appropriately ambitious person in the organization, after a while, they have to pick up some of my verbs because I'm not engaging with them in order for them to do their own. And those are fabulous people, and eventually they get frustrated and leave. And that's the last person I want leaving this organization, and I'm sure the same would be said for those who are listening today.
That's right. The best people leave a dysfunctional organization first, which is the best motivation for a leader to take a look at this. Because when I say to them, do you want to do this stuff? And they're like, not really. How do you feel about your best people leaving? They're like, okay, what do I have to
yeah.
do?
Then you will have to do it.
That's right.
Or your board will leave you. Okay,
yeah.
This is so rich. We're going to wrap it up here this time. Thanks again for being kind of with us virtually. And for all of our podcast listeners, you don't have to wait to find out the exciting conclusion of this conversation. You can, this moment, go to wherever you normally purchase books and buy The Motive by Patrick Lencioni. Read it, then come back next time because we're going to unpack some of this stuff and I'm going to kind of drill down between some of the things that he talks about in the book to get even more clarity. In addition to buying the book, I hope you'll visit andystanley.com, where you can download the Leadership Podcast application guide that goes with today's content. Because one of the things that we consistently do with Pat's books is we ask our leadership team to read them and then we discuss the content together, and we've created an application guide to make that even easier for you. So as always, thanks for listening, and be sure to check back in next time as we wrap up this important conversation with Patrick Lencioni, and I will see you next time on the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast.